This is Case Closed, crime stories from the golden age of radio. This is Case Closed. Thanks for coming around again for another 60 minutes of old-time radio crime stories. We'll start off with Stand By for Crime and hear their story from 1953 titled Death on the Tracks. After that, it's Ellery Queen in The Adventure of Dead Man's Cavern, his story from April 15th, 1944.
Stand By for Crime.
Hi, Chuck Morgan again. You know, being a newscaster on a station like KOP is quite a responsibility. No matter whether you're liked or disliked, whether you're agreed with or disagreed with, you feel a sense of duty, especially when you know your listening audience is extensive. That's why when this tip came in about that accidental death, I thought I couldn't pass it up. It wouldn't be fair to the people who paid me or the people who listened to me. The tip said that the accidental death wasn't accidental at all, but murder. It occurred at a remote section town on the Southern Express Railroad. If I drive up there, I get some interesting copy for my broadcast. Well, it so happened that Carol Curtis, my blonde secretary, and I had nothing better planned for the weekend, so we wound up the old jalopy and headed out into the desert.
You know, darling, I think it's a wonderful idea going to Las Vegas for the weekend.
You do?
Yes. I have a new gown I'll wear at dinner tonight. It's a strapless black taffeta with gold embroidery. Think you'll like it? Chuck Morgan, you haven't heard a word I've said.
What was that, Grammarpus?
I said, you think... What are we stopping here for?
That signboard over there. Can you read it?
Signboard? Why, yes, it says squalling Indian. For heaven's sakes, what does that mean?
Well, maybe it means there's an Indian over there who keeps squalling. Come on, we better get started.
Wait a minute, Chuck. You're taking the wrong road. Las Vegas is up that way.
Who cares about Las Vegas when there's a squalling Indian over the hill?
Chuck Morgan, you turn this car around right now. You promised me we were going to Las Vegas.
No, I believe my exact words were, and I quote, Glamour Puss, let's drive out into the desert this weekend, up toward Las Vegas, unquote.
Why, you fiend. You tricked me.
Mm-hmm.
You know I've always wanted to go to Las Vegas. Stop this car at once and let me out of here. What about my new dress? You don't know what it means to a girl to buy a new dress and then have no place to wear it. You stop this car at once and let me out. Well, what are you doing now?
Stopping the car.
What for? We're a million miles out in the desert, and it's so hot I can hardly breathe. The least you can do is keep moving.
Glamorpus, you said you wanted me to stop the car so you could get out.
What? I said that? Don't be silly.
You know something, Glamorpus?
What?
You're really pretty good looking when you're mad.
Oh, is that so? Well, let me tell you something. There are plenty of men who would... What was that?
Sounded like a shot. Yeah, there's a puff of smoke up there on the hill. Probably a hunter.
Chuck, he's shooting at us.
Yeah, our tires anyway. Glamorpus, you're really going to get your wish. You ever work a jack handle before?
Of course not.
There's a first for everything. Out you go. I didn't want to alarm Carol, so I acted as though it were regular routine for me to have my tires plugged full of holes by unknown snipers. Carol sat in the shade of the car and made sarcastic remarks about my integrity while I sweated with a tire iron and finally dislodged the bullet that had deflated the inner tube. It looked to me like a 30-30 special, which proved nothing. Well, I got the spare in place and we headed down the road toward Squalling Indian. An hour later, we came to our destination. It was the most desolate-looking place I've ever seen. Cluster of yellow painted buildings, partly shaded by two cottonwood trees. The double tracks of the Southern Express ran by the front door.
Well, this is just great. This is simply dandy. Shall I change to my new strapless gown with the gold embroidery now, or shall I?
Glamorpus, will you do me one small favor?
What?
Shut up.
Why, the idea.
Quit it. I'm here on serious business, and if you. Here comes someone.
Hello there. Looking for anyone special?
We're looking for anyone.
I know how you feel. Pretty desolate-looking place, isn't it?
Yes.
Come on inside. It isn't much hotter, and I can at least offer you a cold drink.
Oh, that sounds good to me. How about you, Carol?
Yes, sure. I can hardly wait.
My name's Jim Gainsley. I'm the signal maintainer. Oh, here we are. Hi, honey. We got visitors.
Oh, how wonderful. Visitors are always welcome here.
This is Betty, my wife.
Hello, Betty. Nice to know you. This is Carol Curtis, and I'm...
You're Chuck Morgan, the news commentator. I'd know that voice anywhere.
By golly, that's right. You are Chuck Morgan. How about that?
Well, I didn't think my broadcasts were heard this far away.
Oh, we don't get you around here, but I used to live in L.A.
Oh.
Jim and I've only been here 6 months.
Don't you find it terribly lonesome?
Oh, Jim and I are never lonesome if we're together.
It isn't as bad as you think. There's another family living in that house over there. Ted and Jane Maynard. Ted's the boss of the work gang.
Oh.
Hey, but how about that cold drink I promised?
Great. And I think I'd better explain to you why we happened to drop in on you so unexpectedly.
Well, sit down and make yourselves comfortable first.
All right.
Now you're here, we want to encourage you to stay as long as possible.
That's very nice of you.
Here's that cold drink.
Hey, Carol?
Thanks.
Take this one.
Thank you. By the way, that man that was killed up this way last week.
Oh, that was a real tragedy.
Either of you or the Maynards get to talk to him?
None of us even saw the chap till it was over. And then, well, there wasn't much left to identify.
No one ever found out who he was?
No. I understand that an inquiry was conducted, but nothing came of it.
Where did the accident happen?
In the cut, about half mile up the track.
Apparently, the man had been walking along the tracks, heard the train, and climbed the embankment, then slipped and fell. There's a torn-out place at the top of the embankment that makes that theory almost a fact. What's your interest, Mr. Morgan?
Well, it's remote. I had a friend who looked me up in L.A. 2 days before the accident. He's a geologist. Said he was coming up this way to look at some unusual rock formations he'd heard about.
And you haven't heard from him since?
No. Checked a couple of places without any luck. Oh, I'm probably borrowing trouble. Chances are he'll be calling me at the office tomorrow.
Listen. It sounds like a train.
Now, that just could be, Glamour Puss. There are a couple of tracks outside.
It's the Golden Streak Streamliner from L.A. to Chicago.
Right on the nose, too.
Phew. For a minute, I thought it was coming into the room.
She's doing 90 when she passes here.
And the same when it goes through the cut?
Oh, a little better. There's a slight downgrade there.
No wonder there was nothing left of the man who was hit.
How about you two staying overnight with us? There's plenty of room, and when the sun goes down, it really gets cool.
Sure, that's a great idea. We'd sure like your company. I'll help you carry your gear in.
Chuck, you promised.
Sorry, Glamour Puss. Thanks, we'll accept your offer. But there's something I want to say to you first.
Oh, what's that?
I don't think that man being killed was an accident at all. I think he was murdered. Jim and Betty Ainsley weren't as startled by my murder theory as I thought they would be. They seemed more amused than anything. They were willing enough to go along with the gag, however, apparently feeling that to do so would assure them of our company overnight. Jim and I brought in our bags from the car. They gave Carol a room in their own cottage and assigned me another. Beyond me was a cottage occupied by the Ainsley's neighbors. I took off my hat, coat, tie, splashed some cold water over my face, and then strolled over towards the Maynards. Their cottage looked exactly like the one occupied by the Ainsleys, except that the low, drooping branches of a huge cottonwood shut it off from view of the rest of the buildings. I knocked and waited. Wasn't any response. So after a moment, I tried the latch. It opened. I went in.
Anybody home?
If anyone was home, they weren't admitting it. Standing in a corner near the bedroom door was a rifle. I crossed the room quickly, picked it up, opened the breech and sniffed. The gun had been fired recently, and it was a 30-30 special.
Drop that gun!
What? Wait a minute. You must be Ted Maynard.
Never mind who I am. Drop that gun, I said.
Sure, okay. Only don't go getting any ideas with that revolver you're holding until you find out who I am.
Ted, who's this?
I don't know. Some stumble bum thought he could get away with my rifle.
Well, why don't you plug him? If you found him trying to steal something, you've a right to.
Take it easy. I'm Chuck Morgan. My secretary and I are staying with your friends, the Ainsleys.
Who told you they're our friends?
They did. Well, aren't you? Now, how could you possibly live in a remote spot like this and not be friends with the only neighbors you have for miles?
Try it sometime and you'll find out. Especially with two jerks like those Ainsleys.
Oh.
Well, Ted, what are you going to do about it?
I don't know. I'm going to check with Jim and Betty Ainsley to find out if he's telling the truth, that's for sure.
Let's flag down number 9 and turn him over to the conductor for the sheriff at Vegas.
Maybe the heat was giving me hallucinations, but it seemed to me that these two were creating a situation out of thin air for no apparent reason. They were nervous, on edge, desperate. But more important, they were scared and trying to cover it up.
Maybe that's a good idea. Hand me that rope, Jane.
Crazy though it seemed, they were planning to go ahead with their plan. Well, I hadn't driven away up here to be trussed up and dumped aboard a train on some phony charge of robbery.
Oh, all right, Ted. I'll take that.
Why, you... Let go of my wrist.
Drop the gun.
Ted!
All right.
Now then, let's talk this over and see if we can't add up the score.
What are you going to do? Push it off the embankment in front of the streamliner the way you did that poor devil last week?
You won't get away with it this time. You were seen coming up here, you know.
Yes, I know. Seen by someone with a 30-30 special who plugged a hole in one of my tires.
You can't prove that.
Can't prove what?
That it was a 30-30 special.
I can not only prove it, I can identify the gun it came from. I have the bullet in my pocket.
Then if you can do that...
Hey, what's going on here? Thought I heard a commotion.
You did. Your friends here accused me of trying to steal a rifle that belonged to them and threatened to flag down number 9 and turn me over to the conductor.
Oh, forget it, Mr. Morgan. Ted and Jane are just jumpy. Look, come on back to the house. Betty will have dinner ready in a few minutes. We'll have time for a couple of drinks.
Yes, but what about...
Give Ted back his cap pistol and forget the whole thing. Later on this evening, he'll be over crying on your shoulder asking about news of the outside. Now, don't worry about it, Mr. Morgan. Everything's going to be all right.
Maybe everything was all right as far as Jim Ainsley was concerned, but it wasn't all right for me. There's something cockeyed about this setup. It involved 4 people and a dead man. A dead man who'd been pushed in front of a train and ground into nothing. Who was he? What had he been doing out here in this remote settlement? And what connection did he have with these 4 people? Questions. Lots of questions. And so far, only one answer. I was sure the man had been murdered. I could prove it. But I couldn't prove who committed the murder nor who the murdered man was. It wasn't even a corpse to make things easier. A night fell, and it became cooler. We sat in the Ainsley's kitchen and ate dinner by the light of 2 oil lamps. Then I noticed a picture of Jim Ainsley on the wall, dressed in a naval uniform, and remarked about it. Were you in the Navy, Jim? Noticed your picture up there.
Oh, the one on the bulkhead?
Yeah.
That's my brother, Mike. Most people make the same mistake. We do look a lot alike.
Is he in the service now?
No, he was killed in action off Korea.
Oh, that's tough.
It was tough losing Mike. And all the family I had. We lived in Chicago. That's where I met Betty. She'd come on from L.A. with some kind of convention.
You were married in Chicago?
That's right. I had this chance to come out here, and Betty liked being near home, so I grabbed it.
On our first weekend off, we're going to go to L.A. Jim's never met my folks. Oh, here's Ted and Jane. Hi, kids. Come on in.
Hi, everyone. Say, Mr. Morgan, Jane and I want to apologize for our actions this afternoon. I guess you must think we're pretty stupid.
Well,
We really wouldn't have put you aboard that train, even though you have submitted.
See, Mr. Morgan, what did I tell you?
How about a cup of coffee, kids? Oh, by the way, this is Carol Curtis, Mr. Morgan's secretary. I don't believe you've met her.
Now, how do you do? Oh,
how do you do?
Now, how about the coffee?
Oh, swell.
I like them. Smells good to me.
Me too.
Well, now I had the answers. This crazy pattern was beginning to straighten itself out. I knew who the dead man was, and who had murdered him, and why. All I had to do was prove it. The plan had already begun taking shape in my mind. I had to get back to Los Angeles, and I had to get back there fast. Because it was in Los Angeles that I could start the machine going that would bring one of these 4 people up to the bar of justice, charged with murder.
Now, the conclusion of Stand By for Crime.
Carol and I got back to Los Angeles shortly after 10 p.m. I left at her apartment and drove over to KOP. Pappy Mansfield, owner and manager of the station, was still in his office. I told him where I'd been and what I wanted him to do. He wasn't much impressed.
Oh, you're out of your mind, Chuck. The heat must have soaked through that thick skull of yours and softened up your brain. Now go on home and go to bed.
Okay, Pappy, so you don't believe me. Then you don't mind if I sell the story elsewhere.
Story? What story? You haven't got any story.
I will have before the night's over if you'll give me some cooperation.
But I tell you, Chuck, it's unreasonable. You can't prove there's been a murder without a body.
Yes, I can, if the murderer confesses to his crime. Well, how about it?
No.
Okay. Then I'll peddle my wares somewhere else.
Not while you're on my payroll, you don't.
Then, as of now, I'm off your payroll. I quit.
Hey, Chuck.
Yeah?
Come back here.
I thought you'd see it my way.
Oh, you did?
Hmm?
Well, get this, smart boy. I'll make your telephone call for you, but the name of this radio station isn't going to be mentioned unless you come up with a real...
Pappy and I have been through this sort of thing before. It was old routine. I'd threatened to quit, or he'd threatened to fire me, and then we'd agree to go along together. So I knew I could depend upon him, and it was a comforting feeling. I got the information I wanted from the morgue in the KOP newsroom, and then headed back for the desert. It was after 2 o'clock in the morning when I reached Squalling Indian. There was a light in Jim Ainsley's cottage. Otherwise, the place looked deserted.
That you, Mr. Morgan?
It's me, Jim.
Began to think you weren't coming. Come on inside.
Right.
Yeah, where's Miss Curtis?
She had enough, decided to stay in town. Your wife in bed?
Oh, yes.
And the Maynards?
Well, they stayed till about midnight, hoping you'd be back. Ted said if he heard your car, he'd be over. Gosh, Mr. Morgan, what's it all about?
Well, I got the information I wanted, and if things should...
Oh, hello, Ted. Come on in. Mr. Morgan just got back.
Yeah. I heard his car.
So you brought your rifle along, Ted, expecting trouble?
I intend to be prepared if there is any.
Well, you can put the pea shooter away. You won't have any use for it.
I'm keeping it.
Suit yourself.
Hey, yeah, that's funny. Must be trouble along the road someplace. Hello, Squalling Indian. Yeah, that's right. Who? Morgan? Yeah, he's here. It's for you, Mr. Morgan.
Oh, thanks. Hello. Oh, hello, Pappy. What? I don't know. I suppose I could go up there and take a few measurements. Sure, glad to. Call you back. Right. Okay, so long. That was Pappy Mansfield, owner and manager of Station KOP.
He was... wait a minute. How could he be calling on that phone? It isn't even connected with outside lines.
Pappy Mansfield, my friend, can do anything, if he thinks it's important enough.
Well, gosh, Mr. Morgan, what's so important? What's he want you to do?
I'm going up to the cut and take a few measurements. I think the information I'll be able to phone back to Pappy will be all that's needed to sew up this case.
Well, what case? Oh, look, Mr. Morgan, want me to go with you? I could run you up on my scooter.
No, you two stay here. There might be another phone call. I won't be gone long.
So I started alone, walking up the tracks. There was a crescent moon hanging on the horizon. This and a sky full of stars shed faint light, bringing out in grotesque relief the shape of the giant cactus and the yucca trees. Up ahead, the cut loomed vaguely, a slit and a ridge that gave a backbone to the desert where it slipped down into a salt sink. A cold wind whipped through the cut and penetrated the thinness of my jacket. Once I looked back, I saw that the lights in Jim Ainsley's cottage had been extinguished. Well, this was it. Either I had a crazy theory or I was going to turn up one of the best news stories of the year. I didn't expect the thing to happen when it did. I expected it to come from another direction and in another form. I reached the bottom slope of the embankment that formed the cut and turned off the tracks. When I heard a sound like the clanking of stone against metal, I whirled. There was a quick step behind me. Something swished through the air, and then... all the stars in that beautiful sky crashed around my head, and the crescent moon shot out of its orbit and left the world to darkness and to me. I don't know how long I lay there, but after a while, the moon got back into position, and the stars returned to their velvet canopy one by one. I watched them for a while, thinking how beautiful they were, wishing the Carol Curtis were in hand to enjoy their splendor, too. Then it occurred to me that it was strange I didn't have to turn my head upward to see these stars.
The answer was simple. I was already looking up. I was lying on my back. I tried to move and found I couldn't. That answer was just as simple. My hands and feet were tied. Worse than that, they were tied to the railroad track. No, it wasn't a bad movie. It wasn't a Corning novel of 50 years ago. It was real. It was happening to me, Chuck Morgan, wise guy news commentator. And now came the payoff, the climax to this lousy drama. The train, the streamliner, rushing across the desert at 90 miles an hour. Its headlights stabbing into the sky. Its impersonal whistle blasting out, shattering the desert stillness into a nightmare of sound. This couldn't be happening. I was watching one of those movies that used to give me goose pimples when I was a kid. In a minute, the audience would see that the train was on another track. I could feel the vibration of the onrushing demon in the rails. I sawed frantically. The raw edge of the rail flange began to rub the rope thin. I worked wildly, jerking my wrist back and forth, forgetting in this concentration for the moment the train. Forgetting it until a beam of light flashed into my face. A red beam. I looked up. The signal tower, 100 yards down the track, had turned red suddenly. The streamliner was slowing down, coming to a stop. Suddenly, the ropes around my wrist parted. I untied my ankles, stood up, chafing my wrists. The streamliner's headlight showed me the man standing at the foot of the embankment. He had a rifle in the crook of his arm.
You're not as lucky as you think, Morgan. They're still going to shovel up what's left of you after the train passes.
Hello, Ainsley. I didn't think you'd come up with anything so corny as tying me to the rails. Why didn't you drill me with the rifle you stole from Ted Maynard and call it a day?
Because I don't like corpses hanging around. They talk too much.
Oh, of course. I should have remembered.
Before I knock you off, suppose you tell me how much you know.
Gladly. Anything to stall for time until the train crew gets up here.
The train crew ain't coming up here. She only stopped because I got the signals crossed. You'll be underway again in a minute. I'm not too good at this sort of thing.
Naturally not. You're better at signaling from the deck of a battleship.
So you do know, huh?
Yes. I've known for quite a while. You're Jim Ainsley's twin brother, Mike. You were married to Betty before you went to Korea. After you were reported missing, Betty married Jim. You came back, found your wife married to your brother, and killed him. It was Jim who was hit by the streamliner last week.
Hello, Pappy.
Oh, I know, Trip Ainsley, but it always works. I'll take my gun.
Chuck Morgan!
Over here, Pappy!
Chuck, are you all right?
Glamour, puss. Take a look at those stars. Aren't they beautiful? Probably guessed it was Pappy Mansfield who was responsible for the streamliner stopping at Squalling End, not the fact that Ainsley loused up the signals. Pappy never did trust me when he thought I was getting myself into a jam. Carol and I left Squalling End in a cold light of an early dawn, heading for the main highway. Naturally, Carol was full of questions, but this time I had all the answers.
Let's begin at the beginning, Chucky boy. What made you suspicious in the first place?
Why, the fact that Jim, or rather Mike Ainsley, said he recognized my voice.
Didn't he?
No, how could he? He lived in Chicago all his life. My voice couldn't reach that far. Betty had heard me in L.A., but her husband picked her up too quickly on it.
Oh, but how did you know that Jim was Mike?
Well, Jim, or Mike, offered to help us bring in our gear from the car. The word gear in place of luggage is strictly a Navy term.
And then there was the picture of the sailor boy on the wall.
That's right, which Mike called a bulkhead. Navy again.
Well, well, well. Now, who shot the hole in our tire?
Ted Maynard. You see, Ted and Jane knew, or at least suspected, that Jim was a murderer. They were scared stiff. They knew if the Ainsleys realized their suspicions, the same thing would happen to them that happened to Jim.
Well, how about Betty?
Betty had to go along with the gag, too. Although, I think she did it by choice.
She really loved her first husband, huh?
Hmm, that's right.
So when Ted saw us heading this way, he shot a hole in our tire, hoping we'd find out he did it and have him arrested and taken away from there.
Glamour Puss, you have an astute mind.
Oops. Here we are, back on the main highway.
But Chuck, why are you turning right? L.A.'s back that way.
Glamour Puss, Las Vegas is this way. You're still going to have a chance to wear that black strapless taffeta with the gold embroidery.
Oh, Chuck.
What's wrong? What's the matter?
I left it in L.A.
The Adventures of Ellery Queen. For all you men and women in the armed forces of the United Nations, a rebroadcast of radio's thrilling mystery drama, The Adventures of Ellery Queen. Now, here's Ernest Chappell to introduce the guests and the show.
Ellery Queen invites you to match wits with him as he relates another story of a crime he alone unraveled. Before revealing the solution, he stops the play, gives you a chance to solve the mystery. Our guest armchair detectives for this evening are Miss Marjorie Lawrence, Metropolitan Opera star, and Mr. Beverly Kelly of the Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey combined shows. And now, Ellery Queen, master detective and your host for the next half hour.
Thank you, Ernest Chappell, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Well, tonight we tell you the strange mystery of the ghost in the mountaintop cave. I call it The Adventure of Dead Man's Cavern.
Hello? But Mr. Queen doesn't know anyone in Canoga, New York, operator.
Canoga, New York? Give me that phone, Nikki.
Why the excitement, Mr. Queen?
Hello, operator. Ellery Queen. Put her on, please.
Put her on.
Hello, Grace?
Ellery, how's the mastermind?
It's grand to hear your voice, darling.
Darling?
What are you doing at your Adirondack Lodge, Grace?
Stretching my soul. How would you like to join me this weekend?
It's a date. How about my gang, Dad Veely and my secretary?
Well, really.
Oh, sure, I'll have a lodge full anyway. Wait a minute, dear. I'll look up the train schedule.
You bet, darling. I'll hold on.
Ellery Queen, if you think I'm going to kick my heels around an Adirondack... shameless woman.
Grace? Why, Nikki, she's Dr. Grace Grayson, probably the most famous living woman physicist. An old friend.
Oh? How old?
About 50, Nikki.
Oh.
Ellery?
Yes?
There's a 9:45 out of Grand Central Saturday morning. I'll pick you and your folks up at the Canoga Station. It'll be fun.
Grace, I don't like that laugh. What have you got up your sleeve?
Oh, the fact is, you can help catch a murderer this weekend.
I thought so. Who is he?
A gentleman known as the Strangler.
The Strangler? That sounds grim. How many people has he killed?
29 at last report, Mel. See you Saturday.
Strangler. I could strangle you, Grace. String me along about catching a murderer who's been dead over 100 years. Why didn't you tell me he's the ghost of a local legend?
Well, I wanted to excite your curiosity, Ellery. Refill Inspector Queen.
No mind if I do, Dr. Grayson.
I'm getting plastered on this mountain air. So you got a ghost up here, eh, Doc?
Lives in a cave near this lodge, you said?
Yes, called Dead Man's Cavern.
Your three other guests seem mighty interested in that haunted cave, Grace.
Mr. and Mrs. Gabriel and Ernest Withers?
Hmm?
Well, I suppose I ought to warn you. Hector Gabriel and Ernest Withers are supernaturalists. Spend their lives running down ghosts.
Oh,
here they come. Going to join us on the porch, gentlemen?
Oh, Gabriel, you're a gullible idiot. The way you were taken in by that ectoplasm trick in Seattle.
Well, you would have been fooled, too, Withers.
Oh, really? Remember how I exposed that crowd of fake mediums in Nashville, Gabriel? But you were ready to tell the whole
Withers,
world.
Withers, you annoy me.
Sit down,
oh,
boy. Now, that's the way it's been with those two for 20 years, Ellery. Friendly enemies.
Mr. Gabriel, I'm told you have the largest and most valuable library of psychic works in the world.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Queen.
Eh, Withers?
Lucky dog. You've got books I'd give my right arm for.
Dr. Grayson tells us you two gentlemen are up here to investigate that haunted cave, Mr. Withers.
That's right, Inspector.
We're going to conduct a scientific experiment.
Now, see here, Hector Gabriel. I'll let you and Withers turn my lodge into a psychic laboratory, but don't drag the respectable name of science into it.
Are there actually psychic manifestations, Grace?
Oh, Lord, some lug in 1840 began strangling people in that cave, and ever since then, they've...
What's that?
Sounds like a wolf or something. Shh. Listen. Why, that's the moan, Gabriel. The ghost sound.
Now someone's screaming. That's no ghost.
Sounds like my wife. Told her Miss Porter took a walk in the woods and...
Here they come, running. Wife, Mrs. Gabriel.
Oh, hold it, dearest.
Nicky, what happened?
We were walking in the woods, Inspector, when that ghastly moaning started from the direction of that cave. Mrs. Gabriel got frightened. Hector, please, don't you and Mr. Withers go near that cave. It's haunted.
Why, hold of us, what Withers and I came here for.
Yes, Mrs. Gabriel, if those moans were made by a ghost, it's our duty to psychic science.
Now,
to...
see here, those sounds are a natural phenomenon, nothing ghostly about them. Then what made that noise, Dr. Grayson?
My dear child, the cavern probably has a peculiar rock structure which causes it to catch the wind at the top of the mountain and then expel it with a moaning sonic effect.
There it is again.
Sure sounds funny, Harry. What do you think?
I think, Dad, we'd better have a look at Dead Man's Cavern.
Grace, must we go through these woods to get to the cave?
Yes, Ellery. No way of going around it. Sheer cliff on either side.
I wonder why the moan stopped with us.
Exasperating, Gabriel. Hold it, everybody. Someone coming. Sounds like a big, heavy man.
Wasn't the strangler supposed to be big and heavy?
Oh, nonsense, Sergeant. It must be Hank Pete. Oh, I was right. Hi, Hank.
Hi, Professor. You hear them moan from Dead Man's Cavern, too?
Yes, we're going to the cavern now. Hank, these are friends of mine.
How do you do?
How do you do?
All right, Billy, get moving.
Strangler's getting pretty restless lately.
Huh? Say, Daniel Boone, you don't believe in this ghost bunk, too.
Man gets to believe in a lot of things, mister. Living alone up here in the hills.
Just what is the story of this strangler, Mr. Gabriel?
Well, some mountaineer, Mr. Queen, over...
Let me tell him, Gabriel. He lured wayfarers into the cave, you see, and strangled them for their money.
Nice fella.
What did he do with his victims' bodies?
There's a natural opening in the rear wall of the cave, like a window.
It overlooks a lake, Inspector, the same lake that's behind my lodge.
The strangler threw his victims out of that cave window into the lake 50 feet below.
Never since them folks he strangled keep a moaning like you all heard.
Oh, of all the succotash, Hank, the brute was finally caught and hanged.
It's the ghost of the strangler, murdering one of his victims all over again. Well, here we are.
Right at the top of my mountain.
Why, there's a clearing here between where the woods stop and the entrance to the cave.
Hey, ain't that a wooden door covering the entrance to the cave?
Yes, Sergeant.
Let's cross the clearing.
Good, really.
Well, how come a door, Grace?
Hank Pete knows more about it than I do.
Some city fella a few years back put the door in, charged admission to see the haunted cave.
Was his name P.T. Barnum?
One night he was in here alone, and the moan started. He lit out like a buck deer, and he ain't been seen since.
Good stout door. Let's go in.
I think I'll stick right here by the entrance.
Sergeant, you'd never make a physicist.
Or a psychic research worker, either. Interesting cavern, eh, Mr. Queen?
Yes, Mr. Gabriel, from what I can see of it in this gloom.
Solid rock. No walls. Roof.
The roof is really the inside of the very crest of the mountain, Inspector.
And there's the window in the rear wall. Yes, this opening looks right out over the lake. Sheer drop of 50 feet.
What kind of experiment are you gentlemen intending to conduct here, Mr. Withers?
Well, Gabriel and I plan to spend an entire 24 hours in this cave, Inspector Queen, from 6 tomorrow morning until 6 a.m. the following day.
We'll take food, water, blankets, oil lamps, and a sound recording apparatus. We want to be in here when the morning begins.
Very scientific, you see.
Go ahead, jeer, you female Philistine.
Really?
Dutch wine coming in?
Well, I got lonesome out there. Say, supposing you meet up with this ghost, don't you gents think you better pack a rod just in case?
If what's making them sounds could be shot, he'd be a dead ghost long ago.
We're taking every precaution against the possibility that the moans are caused by a human agency. We pick tomorrow for our vigil because the weather forecast for tonight is heavy rain. And the rain will soak down the loose earth of the clearing in front of the cave.
Yes, get it so soft that anyone approaching the cave will have to leave footprints in the mud. Well, let's go back, eh?
Yes, but you gentlemen will leave footprints when you cross the muddy clearing tomorrow morning.
We'll cross it barefoot to identify our own prints.
Appears to me like you two fellas aim to tinker with trouble.
My dear Pete, ghosts don't scare us. Gabriel, you have that new lock we brought out?
Yes, Withers. Ah, there. And the key remains in my pocket. Well, that's all until tomorrow morning at 6. If you want to see us off, you'll have to be up early.
We'll be up early, Mr. Gabriel.
Gosh, I'm sleepy, Ellery. Mrs. Gabriel and I had to double up last night, and she moaned all night long. Are the others following us?
All except Hector Gabriel.
I wonder where Gabriel is. He bunked with me last night, but when I woke up this morning, he was already gone.
He must be waiting for us at the cave. Oh, look, Ellery. Is that the old woodsman Dr. Grayson mentioned last night?
Hank Pete? So, yes. Morning, Hank.
Great.
Up early to see Mr. Gabriel and Mr. Withers start their watch in the cave?
Mr. Green, I just been over to the clearing at the edge of the woods. Somebody's in that cave.
What?
Cave door's open.
What's that, Hank? Cave door open?
Why, it can't be. Gabriel and I put a new lock on it yesterday, and he has the only key.
Come see for yourselves.
It must be your husband, Mrs. Gabriel.
Well, I don't understand it, Sergeant. But weren't Mr. Gabriel and Mr. Withers to go into the cave together?
Yes, we were.
Keep your shirt on, Mr. Withers.
Take a look.
The prints of a small man's bare feet.
And they go perfectly straight across the mud of the clearing to the cave door.
Just one set of prints. Ingoing.
Why, he's tricked me. His word of honor, we'd go in together. His word of honor.
I'm sure Hector wouldn't do anything dishonorable, Mr. Withers.
Well, these are his footprints, aren't they? There couldn't be anyone else's here. They're so small. Cheat.
Mr. Withers, you're a dreadful man.
Oh, it's probably a joke. Hector Gabriel!
Mr. Gabriel!
Hey, Mr. Gabriel!
Hector! Why don't you answer?
Something's wrong.
Dad, I'm crossing this clearing alone. I'll detour to keep out of the way of Gabriel's footprints. If you have to follow me, detour too.
Right, son.
Dad, Billy.
Coming, Ellery. Come on, Billy.
I'm coming.
Something wrong, son?
What is it, Maestro?
Look.
Gabriel. On the cave floor.
With all his supplies around him.
Dead. Dead about an hour, I'd say. Since 5 a.m.
Face contorted by a horrible fear.
And no wonder. Look at his neck. He's been strangled.
Well, son, I don't get it. Even these marks of strangulation are queer.
You mean the upward-pointing thumb impressions at the back of Gabriel's neck?
Yes. Why weren't the thumbprints in his windpipe?
Oh, what was that?
It's Grace Grayson, Sergeant.
You and Hank Pease didn't mess up Gabriel's footprints in crossing the clearing, did you?
No, Ellery, we detoured, too. Poor Gabriel, I can't believe it yet. Hank, look at him.
The ghost of the strangler, I told
you. Will you stop jabbering about ghosts, Daniel Boone?
You're scared. Get out of here.
Stop it, Hank. What are we going to do? Poor Holder's in a state of collapse. Nicky's trying frantically to calm her down, and that man with us hasn't uttered a word since this happened. Who did it?
Come outside. I want to show you something.
What is it, son?
The only way Gabriel's murderer could have got into the cave was the way Gabriel got in, by crossing this muddy clearing.
Well?
Well, Where are the killer's footprints?
You didn't see no prints in this mud when we got here this morning, except the ones of Gabriel's bare feet, did you?
I see. Obviously, the strangler entered the cave some other way.
How, Grace? The only other opening into the cave is that natural window in the rear wall, which overlooks the lake. And that opening is 50 feet above the lake at the top of a sheer cliff.
The roof of the cave. Let a rope down.
We've been up there. It's covered with smooth mud.
And no human foot ever stepped on it.
And at the sides of the cave, it's sheer precipice, too. Oh, well, of course. The killer came here during the rain, which wiped out his prints. Lay in wait for Gabriel, who came when the rain had stopped.
What happened to the prints the killer made leaving?
That's not the important point, Dad. The killer couldn't have got into the cave before Gabriel, Grace. The door was locked with a new lock, and only Gabriel had the key, which is still on his person.
Then the killer used a grappling iron at the end of a strong line.
You mean throw a line up from the lake, Grace?
Yes. Someone stood in a boat on the lake below and threw up a grappling iron which caught the window.
Guess again, Dr. Grayson. The nine would have left scratch marks on the sill of the rocky opening.
And there ain't no scratch marks.
Then how do you explain it?
You're wasting your time. Ghosts don't need grappling irons. And they don't leave footprints.
Yes, Grace. Remarkable as it seems, it looks as if Hank Pete is right. In the setup, Hector Gabriel could only have been strangled by a ghost.
All this stuff. You've been crying a whole day and night.
But they took Hector away, Nicky. Why don't they let me go? I don't want to stay here.
What's the inspector up to? He keeps telephoning.
What's going on, Ellery?
I don't know, Grace. I'm still grappling with the problem of the strangler ghost.
Wait.
The moans from the cave again.
Oh, don't be silly, Nicky. It's the wind.
The wind, is it? It's the ghost. The ghost who strangled Hector. They guess he was all here to be murdered. I'm going.
Where are you going, Mrs. Gabriel?
Oh, Dad.
Billy, shut that door and set your back against it.
Right, Inspector. Ghosts, huh?
Miss Gabriel, did I hear you say you were going somewhere?
Yes, Inspector. Home. And you can't stop me.
Miss Gabriel, I've done a lot of investigating my phone in the past 24 hours. One of the things I've discovered is that your husband was a rich man.
Hector, I suppose so, but...
What is it, Dad?
I've had Gabriel's will checked, Ellery. Leaves nearly his entire estate, worth a couple of million dollars, to his wife, Hulda.
You mean you think I killed Hector?
Your husband was almost 20 years older than you, Mrs. Gabriel.
Oh.
Yes, quite possible.
Well, you're crazy. Next thing we know, you'll be accusing me of strangling Gabriel.
Exactly what I had in mind, Mr. Withers.
Wait, what do you mean, Inspector?
You and Gabriel were at each other's throats for over 20 years, Withers. Enemies.
Why, we were friendly enemies.
Also, we owned something you wanted bad, Mr. Withers.
Gabriel's library. The most valuable collection of books on psychic phenomena in the world.
Right, son. One of the things I found out in the past 24 hours is that Gabriel willed his psychic library to Ernest Withers.
But that's so absurd, Inspector, to kill a man for possession of some books.
You think so, Dr. Grayson? Maybe you'll agree that your motive was stronger.
My motive? To kill Hector Gabriel?
Dad, Grace involved with Gabriel.
She was his first wife.
Gabriel's first wife? Did you know that, Ellery?
No, I didn't, Nicky. Grace.
Surely you're joking, Inspector.
Depends on your sense of humor, Dr. Grayson. Fact is, Hector Gabriel ditched you to marry Hilda.
And you know what they say about a woman's scorn.
So you think I killed Hector out of revenge for having thrown me over? I can see your point, Inspector. Only I didn't.
It's not any one of us. It was the ghost, I tell you. The ghost.
Ah, that ghost story is a lot of camouflage.
Yes. One of you three strangled Gabriel in that cave. Only question is, which one?
Now, who would that be?
Billy, see what it is.
Right.
No, please don't open it.
Oh, it's just old Hank, the woodsman.
What do you want, Pete?
Thought you'd want to know.
We'd want to know what, Hank?
Right at the edge of the woods, where you enter the trail from here, just a couple of yards from the lodge, there's a lot of loose stones. Them stones were slippery from the rain.
Well?
Alongside them slippery stones is a couple small juniper bushes. They've been smashed flat. I figure it's how this fella Gabriel slipped on them stones on his way to the cave yesterday morning and fell under them junipers.
That's a help, that is.
It certainly is, Sergeant. In fact, it clears up the mystery.
What do you mean, son?
I mean, Dad, that now I know the identity of the ghost of Dead Man's Cavern. And there, ladies and gentlemen, you have the mystery of Dead Man's Cavern. Have you an answer to it? Well, suppose you compare solutions with our guest armchair detectives. Nikki, will you please introduce our guests?
Well, Ellery, our first guest tonight is Miss Marjorie Lawrence, famous metropolitan soprano. Stricken with infantile paralysis a couple of years ago, Miss Lawrence has fought against this dread affliction courageously and successfully, as evidenced by her recent triumph in the role of Isolde at the Met. Our second guest tonight is Mr. Beverly Kelly of the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Combined Shows, or, as all America calls it, the circus, now playing at Madison Square Garden. Mr. Kelly has described the big top to millions over the radio and is well-known author of books and stories on circus life. All right, Ellie?
Thanks, Nikki. Miss Lawrence, who strangled Gabriel?
Well, I don't think anyone strangled him. I think that he slipped and fell on those stones under the juniper bushes.
Yes.
I think the moaning sounds came from natural means somehow. The wind through the rocks or something.
Yes.
So that's what I would say.
Well, thank you, Miss Lauren. And now, Mr. Kelly, who do you think strangled Gabriel?
Well, Ellery, if those footprints outside the cave weren't so small, I think we could blame it on Gargantua. But I think I'm going to put my money on Gabriel's first wife and say that he fell from grace.
Well, thank you, Mr. Kelly.
What do you mean?
All right, I'll tell you. Now, first, let's lay the ghost. No ghost killed Hector Gabriel. The strangler's hands were human hands. They left human fingerprints deep in the flesh of Gabriel's neck and throat.
Well, sure. That's right. Then those moans we heard must have been made by the wind through the cave like Dr. Grayson said.
Right, Sergeant. Now, since the strangler had human hands, he also had human feet. And human feet leave prints in mud.
But Ellery, the only footprints in the mud were Gabriel's. One set, in going.
I know. Gabriel choked in the woods and then staggered across the clearing alone to the cave to die.
Nikki, you yourself pointed out that the trail left by Gabriel's feet across the mud was perfectly straight. Men dying of strangulation don't walk in a straight line. No. When Gabriel crossed that clearing, unlocked the door, and entered the cave, he was perfectly well. So the murder was committed in the cave. And for the murderer to have choked Gabriel in the cave, he had to get there. Problem. How did the killer cross that muddy clearing without leaving footprints? And the more you think about it, the more obvious the answer gets.
What do you mean?
He crossed it on Gabriel's back.
Gabriel carried him. Henry.
I know, Dad. Other theories are possible, but my theory can be backed up. What was the exact position of the strangler's thumbs on Gabriel's neck?
The thumb marks pointed upwards on the back of Gabriel's neck.
Which is possible only if at the time he committed his crime, the strangler was behind Gabriel. Strong confirmation that the strangler rode across that mud on Gabriel's back. And when Gabriel entered the cave, the person he was carrying began to choke him before even getting down.
Oh, but Maestro, how did the killer make Gabriel carry him?
Important question, Sergeant. Grown men don't play piggyback at 5 o'clock of an Adirondack morning. One person carrying another suggests that the person being carried had to be carried.
An injury?
Yes, Dad. Hank Beach just told us he'd found a place in the trail where someone had slipped on loose, wet stones and fallen into some juniper bushes. Hank opined it was Gabriel, because he thought Gabriel was alone. But since we know Gabriel carried someone, isn't it evident that it wasn't Gabriel who slipped and fell, but his companion?
The killer faked a tumble, pretended to twist his ankle or something, said he couldn't walk. Gabriel lugged him all the way through the woods to the cave.
Exactly. And why? Deliberately to leave only one set of footprints in that mud. Gabriel's. To make us believe that the murder had been the work of a convenient strangler ghost of the haunted cave.
All right, all right. You've accounted for how the strangler got into the cave without leaving prints.
Yeah.
But how'd he get out, Maestro, without leaving him after Gabriel was dead?
In the only way possible, through that natural window in the cave wall.
What?
Yes, for while no one could have got into the cave through the opening in the cave wall, someone could have got out simply by diving out into the lake below.
But you did all this, son.
Dad, where did Hank say he found the crush bushes?
At the edge of the woods, as you entered the train leaving Dr. Grayson's lodge.
Yes, yes. In fact, Hank said it was only a few yards from the lodge. But observe, the killer pretends to injure himself a few yards from the lodge. Yet Gabriel carries him all the way through the woods to the cave. Why? Why didn't Gabriel carry him back the few yards to the house? Wouldn't he have done that if, say, his companion had been his wife or Dr. Grayson, or in fact, anyone except one person?
One person.
There can be only one reason why Gabriel carried his companion all the way to the cave. And that was because he and the killer were bound for the cave. Because he and the killer were supposed to share the cave for the next 24 hours.
Well, I'll forget.
Gabriel's companion, the man who got his victim up an hour earlier than planned on some trumped-up excuse, who wanted to kill Gabriel because he hated him for over 20 years and because Gabriel had willed him his unique and valuable psychic library, that man could only have been Ernest Withers.
That's Case Closed for this week. I hope you enjoyed today's selections. If not, come back next Wednesday. We'll try again. Until then, there's more old-time radio at relicradio.com, past episodes of this show, all the other podcasts, a link to our Shoutcast stream with even more old-time radio, and our donate button if you'd like to help support it all. Thanks, as always, to those who have. And thanks for joining me today. Talk to you again Wednesday with another episode of Case Closed. Case Closed is produced by and for relicradio.com. Rebroadcast of this show without permission is strictly prohibited.